From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Adult businesses recently lost a few more rounds against the city of Sandy Springs. The Georgia Supreme Court ruled against an appeal by Maxim Cabaret challenging the constitutionality of Sandy Springs' ban on alcohol sales and on zoning restrictions for strip clubs and other adult businesses. The case follows two similar suits struck down earlier this spring. Both petitioned to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the High Court decided not to review the case of Flanagan's Enterprises, which operated a business selling sex toys. Sandy Springs established zoning restrictions and banned alcohol sales for strip clubs and other adult businesses in 2006. Well, our search for the origins of these laws led to a number of curious ordinances still on the books in Georgia. Here are just a few.
It's illegal!
It's really illegal?
Is this illegal? Excuse me? Is this allowed?
It's illegal.
It's illegal to give a state senator a speeding ticket when the state assembly is in session.
It's illegal to cuss on landlines.
Across the state, it's illegal to swear in front of a corpse.
It's illegal to throw bird seeds at a bird. As it should be!
In Acworth, you must own a rake or be sent to jail.
It's illegal to use your PlayStation after 11 p.m. on a school night in Athens.
I wonder if the Xbox is okay.
Also in Athens, no drinking beer while getting a back rub.
That might be difficult anyway.
You must keep your pet chicken on a leash.
In Marietta, you must be on a truck to spit
from a moving vehicle. Ew, why would you want to...
The floor of a porno store must be smooth and non-absorbent.
It's illegal to have happy hour drink specials.
What?
I'm not sure that's a good idea.
Even strippers get Sundays off in Roswell.
Good for them. Everybody should take a rest. In Athens...
It's illegal to fart at the state fair.
Oh my God. What?
Seems like that should be illegal everywhere.
Well, we cribbed a few on this list from idiotlaws.com, if that tells you anything. As obscure and seemingly silly as they are still on the books. And here to talk with us about how laws get made and how hard they are to change is Tanya Washington. She's a law professor at Georgia State University. Great to have you back in the studio, Tanya.
Great to be here.
So let's start. Why do these kind of laws even exist?
Well, a lot of laws came into being during a particular time. Right, where it would have been necessary or it would have made more sense for the law to be created. And with the passage of time and the changes that have occurred over that time period, they no longer make sense, but they're still on the books, which means they are still enforceable.
So what does it take to get one of those laws off of the books?
Well, one way it can happen is the legislature can pass another law invalidating the existing law. Another way is for someone who is against whom the law is enforced to challenge it in court and for the court to invalidate it as unconstitutional.
So short of a lot of money, time and will to make it happen, they're just going to stay on the books.
Exactly. Exactly.
So you said they're made during a particular time. Are they targeting particular people or groups of people?
It could be people. It could be certain behaviors. It could be something that is perceived to be beneficial to the community at that particular time. And it's often based on time-stamped norms, right? And so things that may have been appropriate in the early 1900s are no longer appropriate in 2018. And we're looking at the reasonableness of the law through the lens of present reality.
So it may have made sense at one point to make a law that you can't curse in front of a corpse.
Absolutely. If that's based on prevailing beliefs, spiritual or religious, and there was a majoritarian support for that law, then it comes into being.
Yeah. So somebody could conceivably be arrested for not having a rake, for example.
Exactly.
So, and that means it's left up to what, the discrimination of an arresting officer?
It's left up to their discretion. And it's interesting because that then leaves room for what you referenced, which is discriminatory exercise of that discretion, right? So you don't enforce the requirement that you have a rake against everyone, but you can against anyone. And so the person who is making that determination gets to draw on their own personal prejudices and biases in determining the person against whom they will enforce the law.
Well, I'm going to pick up on that word discriminatory because some of these are
seems maybe born of very racist or segregationist ideas, like particular populations get targeted?
Absolutely. And that, again, would be consistent with the time period within which they may have been enacted.
So, for example, there is a law, you have to write your signs in English, even though, you know, there are many refugee resettlement communities, immigrant communities here in Georgia. And if it is in one particular language, then you must have a translation. That seems to be clearly biased towards a certain segment of the population. So what happens when it's enforced in one place but not another? Can the person being charged use it as a defense? You know, they get to do it. Why don't I?
That defense is rarely going to be successful. If they are determined to be, according to the facts, in violation of that law, then they can be subject to whatever penalties are attached to having violated that law.
We've got a comment from a listener. Nathan Weaver says, I think back in the day, lawmakers were just more jovial and humorous with some of these laws. Probably argued with each other less, too. So, example, the no farting law. It may have been a crack at somebody's... That's funny. Well, you know, that's the thing. I mean, they do sound really kind of ridiculous to us today, but there was some real, there must have been a real will to make it happen.
Absolutely.
At one point.
Because they went through the legislative process of enacting it. And I think that to your, to the comment that was made about there may have been less acrimony among legislators. We also have to remember they were largely all white men, privileged from a certain socioeconomic background. And so there would have been less reason for acrimony.
Well, let us talk about some specific Georgia laws that have baffled people recently. The first is the ordinance forbidding people from sharing food with the homeless. Now, where did that come from?
So that is an old ordinance, even though it has recently been enforced. And it, I guess it was last year when the Georgia State Police and Georgia State University Campus Police started enforcing this ordinance for the first time in decades. And the public response was, oh, you've created this law. But the law was already on the books. If it's on the books, even if it's dormant, meaning it's not being regularly enforced, it still is the law. And at any point in time, someone can do a search, find a law that has not been invalidated, and decide as part of their administrative policy platform that they now want to enforce this law.
Tanya Washington is with us. She's a professor of law at Georgia State University. And we're talking about some of the ways that laws get on the books and stay on the books. But why enforce a law like that?
Well, I've heard justifications offered that they want to make sure that the homeless population is receiving, you know, healthy food, or there's quality control in terms of the distribution of food. But I think given the significance of our homeless population, it just does not make sense to fine people for sharing, essentially. And it's something that to me speaks well of a community when we are willing to share with those who don't have food to eat. And to punish that for policy reasons that just don't justify the prohibition, to me, is wrong.
Yeah, it almost sounds like you don't want to encourage them or something like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. And not feeding them doesn't make them go away, right? It just allows them to remain where they are, except now they're hungry.
Well, I do want to ask you about another law that probably gets debated a little bit more, taxes in Fulton County.
Mm-hmm. So last year there was a tax freeze. I was a beneficiary of that tax freeze, for full disclosure. I was very happy about it. And the Fulton County Commissioner at the time decided to use a very old law that was still on the books that allowed him to, or allowed the commission to, freeze taxes for a year. And this was in response to the hue and cry of the public who saw their taxes doubling, tripling, quadrupling. And so in that instance, thank God that law was still on the books. And, you know, the fact that it hadn't been used in almost 100 years didn't change its enforceability as law. And it was used to provide some tax relief for the public.
So these old laws and new laws. Not always. I mean, though they're difficult to get on the books and off the books, sometimes really benefit people.
Absolutely. And I think people should just be mindful, given how difficult it is for a law to be invalidated, that we on the front end are very intentional about scrutinizing the laws that are being passed, knowing that more than likely they will be on the books for a very long time unless they are challenged.
And they're of a time now. I'm sure that there are a lot of laws that are being proposed, of course, like the new hands-free law.
Yes.
You know, maybe we're going to look back at that and think, oh, just imagine they couldn't hold on to the telephone.
Absolutely.
This is the standard of the day. But do you think people understand the malleability of the laws when it comes to enforcing them? And do you think, like, the police know about it? I mean, this is a code of a long list.
Yes, I don't think the public is as aware of the processes by which laws are enacted. And I think we're even less aware as the public about how laws are invalidated. I think people think if the law doesn't make sense, then it's not enforceable. No, that just means it's enforceable and it doesn't make sense. Now, I would like to think that police officers and others who have the authority of the state behind their action are more aware of these laws. I hope that's what we are paying taxes for in terms of providing training, and that they are educated about the limits of their authority and also the laws that they are responsible for enforcing.
Okay, I missed the obvious Civics 101 question, which is, how does a law get made?
Well, if we're talking about state laws,
right,
someone introduces it. Usually it is because there is a problem, right? There's some issue that needs to be solved, and we think, or a legislator who is elected to represent his or her constituency, thinks that a law should be enacted as part of the solution to that problem. And then there's a vote and majority rules in the state legislative body and in the at the federal level. And then the law is enacted, signed by the executive branch chief, be the governor or the president, and it is signed into law. And there it is, ready for enforcement.
So is there an obvious fix to wiping off some of these old laws on the books?
There is not. What we cannot do is we cannot sit down with all of these laws and take a yellow highlighter and highlight the ones that we think are no longer relevant. Again, they would have to be challenged, which means someone has to suffer some injury, financial, time, et cetera, through a lawsuit challenging this law, and then the court would have to determine that the law is unconstitutional, the law is invalid, and therefore should not be enforced. Short of that, the legislature would have to come back and pass another law that would supersede the law that we determine makes no sense. But there's no way to do it short of legislative processes or judicial determinations.
Just a short amount of time, but is there a law you'd like to see wiped off the books?
I think you should be able to purchase wine before 12:30 in Georgia. I'd like to see that law changed.
As long as you've got a rake, Tanya. Tanya Washington, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Tanya Washington is a professor of law at Georgia State University. And just ahead, is your head spinning from the current economic news? Well, On Second Thought is here to help. We're going to break down trade, tariffs, taxes coming up after the break. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Have you been listening to the economic news lately? If your answer is yes, does the inside of your head sound something like this?
You know, these tariffs are starting to cause a real panic among smart money. And there's going to be consequences if he doesn't back down.
And now the EU has threatened to retaliate with tariffs on Harley-Davidson motorcycles, bourbon, and blue jeans. Wow, that is a real blow to America's midlife crisis industry.
It looks like a lot of Americans who cast a vote for President Trump are losing out in this looming trade war with the world.
Well, you are not alone. Even people who took basic econ in college or who read the financial news regularly are swimming in language that boggles the mind, whether we admit it or not. So here at Second Thought, we would like to break it down. With me in the studio for a shame-free explanation of global economics at this moment in time are Christine Reese. She's a professor of economics at Georgia Tech. Hello, Christine.
Good morning.
And Jacobus Bors. He's assistant dean for international engagement at the J. Mac Robinson College of Business at Georgia State University. Hello.
Good morning.
Well, let's start with some basic vocabulary, like words or phrases that we're hearing daily. Christine, I'm going to start with you. What is a tariff?
A tariff is basically a tax, and it's a tax that's put on goods that are imported from abroad. So, in a sense, a tax on the products that foreign producers sell, as opposed to a tax on domestic producers.
So how is it different from a tax, though? Why is it not called a tax?
Well, it may be just tradition, but in economics terms, we do call it a tax.
How about?
But because it's important to politically, it's especially important to focus on the fact that it's not on domestic producers, it's on foreign producers, and guess what? They don't vote.
So tariffs just on foreign goods.
Mm-hmm.
How is that different than a duty?
It's the same thing.
Duties and tariffs mm-hmm. are the same
mm-hmm.
thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So who can impose them, and on what?
Well, governments on either side can impose them. So we are talking now, or threatening, I should say, to impose tariffs on goods that are imported from China, Mexico, Canada. And the discussion of trade war is a concern that they would then turn around and impose tariffs on the goods that we export to them.
Okay.
And that's why they call it a trade war or a tariff war. And traditionally, in the past, that has a lot of people argue that that brought about the Great Depression. So when trading stops, when both sides start bringing tariffs against each other, that slows down trade. And then, of course, as my students are taught to say, all prosperity comes from trade. So you cut trade. There goes your prosperity.
All right. So we'll look at the implications of that. But first, a little bit more on the explainers. Jacobus, what does it mean to have a trade surplus or a trade deficit?
So a trade surplus is when you export more than you import. A trade deficit is when you import more than you export. So the total amount of goods that cross the border, if we as the United States at this stage run significant trade deficits, which means we import much more goods than we export.
Okay, so is that a normal state of affairs?
Well, in the end, it's probably the best if it's equal for everybody. But trade is one component of how money or resources cross borders. Another one is capital. And so in the United States, foreigners will invest in the United States. So the capital comes into the United States. They even build sometimes factories in the United States. And then we export goods, or in other cases, we import goods. So the trade deficit or trade balance is not, in principle, a good thing or a bad thing. The question is, how do you finance that? If you continue to have a trade deficit, in other words, import more than you export, and you do not have some other way of offsetting that, such as capital flowing into the country, then you would increasingly have to borrow, or rather your reserves, which is the difference between what you earn by selling goods or get when others invest in your country, would go down. And that could put pressure on your currency.
We're getting a little beyond the third grade level for me. So I just want to walk it back for just a moment.
Okay.
And Christine, please jump in. I want you to, I'd love to hear your thoughts on what Jacobus says. But let's walk through a trade agreement. Let's start with NAFTA. Do you want to walk us through that, Christine, or would you like to?
Well, I think that you're really an expert in that. You should.
Okay. Jacobus, how about
mm-hmm.
it?
So NAFTA is a trade agreement between the United States, Canada, and Mexico. Trade agreements are when countries agree to, instead of charging each other tariffs or taxing goods crossing borders, to reduce tariffs. In other words, they collaborate in some way in which they don't tax each other's goods as much as they may tariff other nations' goods.
Okay, so what would be an example of how that works
so
on
the
ground?
In the case of NAFTA, we agreed that goods produced in Canada, Mexico, the United States will have less tariffs than goods produced outside of the trade area. And so the result is that we favor each other. by doing more business mm-hmm. with each other, by not taxing each other for goods that cross our borders. And that makes us stronger. And then the interesting thing is that why do we do this? Why did we create NAFTA? Because it creates a common market. It means that goods flow across these borders, it becomes a larger market, and that also attracts foreign companies to invest in that market in order to be part of that trade bloc. And so that's one of the not directly trade related, but one of the benefits of creating a free trade area or agreement like NAFTA.
How about the TPP or the Trans-Pacific Partnership?
So that would be a different kind of agreement with a larger number of countries around the Pacific Rim. Included also, I mean, the TPP, these trade agreements can either be limited to just goods, certain goods, just goods between the nations, or they could be expanded to include services. They could be included to also provide mechanisms in which they will resolve disputes amongst each other. So the TPP was an agreement. Under negotiation that included a number of nations in the Pacific arena. Of course, the United States borders the Pacific. That would have created a similar kind of structure in which nations in the region that trade a lot of goods and services would all have reduced their tariffs on each other and therefore created a common market.
I wonder, can I pitch in here?
Of course.
I think that taking a really long-term historical perspective is a good way to understand this. When the country was founded, that was a time when there wasn't, income tax came in my mother's lifetime. So we didn't have, all government revenues came from tariffs.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole tax system was designed around taxing other countries' produce. So we started from there and really, starting in the late 1890s, we started getting together and having these what we call trade rounds. And the two countries get together. It's important to understand how they do this. So we start from a place where everybody's got tariffs on everything. Then we get together and they say, okay, we're going to reduce our tariffs because all prosperity comes from trade. And so let's start. I'll drop this if you'll drop that. Now, it could be I'll drop scissors if you'll drop thread. I'll drop coal if you'll drop
Steel.
Okay. So it doesn't, there's no logic to what is dropped. It's just political. So what I wanted to bring us to now is that now we have all these agreements in place that are multilateral. By the way, you mentioned common market. That's the euro.
Mm-hmm.
That's how
right,
that all
like
started.
That's how the European Union
that's
functions.
That's it started, right. And then it became more of a political marriage. But so what we have is this structure of agreements and institutions that are built on a couple hundred years of tariffs randomly being taken off that don't make any sense for all kinds of reasons, don't make any sense anymore. And this is what I think the president is literally sort of calling a stop to all that and saying, this is crazy. It's really, a historical artifact. Let's go back and revisit it all and see if we can make sense of it. And that's why when he said in Canada, my ears perked up. He said, oh, come on, guys, let's just all drop our tariffs. That's the clue. That's what he's really after.
So with me in the studio for a shame-free explanation of global economics at this moment, Christine Reese, you just heard from. She's a professor of economics at Georgia Tech. And Jacobus Bors, he's assistant dean for international engagement at Georgia State University's Business School. Okay, so let me pick up on that for just a second. So if one administration makes a trade agreement, are all future administrations bound to that agreement?
Until they're changed.
Until they're changed.
Right.
In what? Congress, executive branch? How do they get changed?
I think it ranges. So there are sections of a law and you can apply. There's a huge trade negotiation trade department that decides on this and works on it and does the economics of it. And so they can put tariffs on or off. And it usually happens through this big bureaucracy. And there are sections, and then you can go and look up section of the trade law and then see what items are under that. So today, when Jacobus and I we've been recently looking at this, we look at what items enter the section and what don't enter.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why the president can do this as an executive order.
So how are tariffs related to the price of things in the United States?
Well, if something is being imported and we put a tariff on it, let's say we put a tariff of 25%, interesting number, then that producer abroad, say it's a a Chinese producer abroad, they are going to either have to raise their price 25% or take a 25% cut in profit, or cut profit, that amount. So it, we don't know what's going to happen until they make that decision. Now, if we are, if it's a good that's a real important good to us and we can't produce it and we can't get it anywhere else, we might just eat it and just go ahead and pay the 25%. And that way the government would get that tariff. The foreign country, the foreign producer would get their profit. And we would just pay higher prices, which would be a loss to consumers. But we're saying it's okay. On the other hand, if it's a good where there's a lot of international competition, or it's a good where we can substitute, or a good where we could sort of gear up our steel mills and make it ourselves, then we will end up enhancing local producers, domestic producers. They'll take over the business, and the foreign producer will be shoved out of the business, as is exactly what's happening in steel.
All right, let's talk about that on the local level, because, you know, Georgia consumers, Georgia businesses are looking at this. There's some reports of reading one here from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution of a man who owns an HVAC place in, let's see, Kennesaw. He said as soon as there were talks about tariffs, his prices raised. Things went up immediately. So Georgia produces quite a bit of chicken, includes chicken feet. What's happening to that particular product in this current trade climate? Jacobus.
So at this stage, we've not seen tariffs on poultry. There is a potential that if the NAFTA negotiations do not go as we would like them to go, that Mexico may place tariffs on poultry, in which case they would basically tax any Georgia poultry that enters Mexico, which means the price of poultry in imported poultry would increase, which would give the Brazilian poultry producers an advantage. And that is the concern we have with poultry out of Georgia. In similar ways, the tariffs that we imposed on Chinese steel and other steel is resulting in an increase of price of automobiles, somewhere close to $2,000 per vehicle. And that will be something that the consumer will have to absorb in the end. And so that's how the tariffs. So you used the example of chicken feet. So chicken feet is an interesting example. When we talk about trade, we typically say free trade is a good thing because we can specialize in the things we're good at, either where we have a lot of it, like labor in China, or we have special skills or do something very well, the refinement of manufacturing by the Japanese in the 80s. And so if you can do that really well, it gives you an advantage. The other nation, people will specialize, and that's how we would gain out of trade. So that's on the supply side. Well, the chicken feed is an interesting example of how trade increased as a result of demand side. We've had chickens and raised chickens in Georgia for a long time.
Right, for a long time, the chicken feet were just turned into pet food or whatever.
Correct. Because of trade and because of trade liberalization, we had access to the Chinese market. This is part of the WTO entry of China in 2001. And all of a sudden, poultry producers discovered that there's a huge appetite for chicken feet in China. And they started exporting their chicken feet. There are some times when chicken feet are more valuable than chicken wings, believe it or not, certain times of the year. Of course, right when football season starts, chicken wings become very valuable in
the
United States.
Supply and demand, right?
Supply and demand. But here's an example of how trade has allowed us to monetize or to make money of poultry business in ways that we before would not have been able to do, and trade made that possible.
Okay, so we've got just a minute left in this segment, but Christine, I wanted to ask you. You said, you know, threats of a trade war. We're going to have tariffs. What's the tipping point? What's the difference in these announcements and imposing trades?
Well, I think tariffs, that's a really important question to ask, and because all of the supposition we have about who's going to be hurt and who's going to be helped depends on, it assumes that the tariffs actually go into place and that then the other side retaliates and so on. So it all assumes that. Well, if that doesn't happen, then we could get to a place where, as I suggested before, we could perhaps move to a place where we could get rid of all tariffs or get rid of more tariffs, or at the very least re-examine the structure that's there and put tariffs on the things that make sense and take them off of the things that don't make sense.
Well, in what world does that happen? Is that possible?
Oh, absolutely, it is. I think the big picture thing to recognize is the important power position of the United States. We are the global market. We are the world's market. If we stop buying from the rest of the world, they crash. So that's what President Trump is doing, is he's using our strength as the global market. We're the store. And if we don't open our doors to them, they can't sell anything. So we already see some examples of other countries backing off and giving in.
Well, let's pick up this conversation in just a minute after the break. We're breaking down the current trade climate, including tariffs and taxes, with economists Christine Rees and Jacobus Bors.
Cause I'm the tax man. Yes, I'm the tax man. That man is rough.
This is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Trade wars, tariffs, and treaties. We've been breaking down some of the buzzwords in global economic news with my guest, Christine Rees, a professor of economics at Georgia Tech, and Jacobus Bors. He's assistant dean for international engagement at Georgia State University's Business School. And also with us now on the line is Will Harris. He owns White Oak Pastures in Bluffton, Georgia. Hello, Will.
Hello, Virginia. How are you this morning?
Very well. What do you farm there at White Oak Pastures?
Well, we raise grass-fed beef, pork, lamb, goat, and pastured poultry and vegetables. And I was very interested in your last segment. The Georgia Tech guest economics professor made the statement that all prosperity comes from trade.
And what do you think, Will?
I think that prosperity comes from fair trade. And unfortunately, all trade is not fair. As an example, currently, a consumer can walk into a grocery store or a restaurant and order grass-fed beef that is marked product of USA. And the truth is that animal may have been born, grown, slaughtered, and processed in Australia, New Zealand, Uruguay, or a number of other companies. But the consumer would logically believe it was product of USA because that's what the label says. And that's because of a misleading rule that USDA Food and Inspection Service has in place that makes it legal to do that. I think it's certainly misleading. Some would argue intentionally misleading. But it's an unfair trade practice.
Well, I want to give Christine a chance to respond to that. Christine?
That's so true. It's so absolutely true. And I'm a free market economist and have for years worshipped at the altar of free trade, as do Larry Kudlow and a lot of the president's advisors and Secretary Perdue. But it's absolutely true that it's got to be fair trade. And that's why I introduced earlier this idea of the history of it, that it's not that there's fair trade. It's not that it's free trade everywhere. In some cases, and especially in agriculture, the United States has very, very low tariffs in agriculture for goods coming in, where the countries surrounding us have very high tariffs. So there's a really big distinction in ag.
Well, Will, I want to ask you with just a minute left, what would you like to see the government do to make your job, that labeling, easier?
Well, in this particular instance, there's a number of things, but in this particular instance, I am the president of the American Grass-Fed Association, and we have filed a petition with USDA to change that rule, and from now until August 17th, they will be accepting comments from consumers on that, and if any of the listeners want to contact me, Will Harris at whiteoakpastures.com. I'll tell them how they can submit a comment to USDA to help change this horribly misleading rule.
Well, Will, thanks for your input there. And I know you want to get back out to the pasture. Will Harris, owner of White Oak Pastures in Bluffton, Georgia, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, so we have to wrap up here. Thoughts on ongoing. Do you think this is a trade war that's going to happen? First to you, Christine. 30 seconds.
No, I don't think it is. I think, as we've already seen, indication in almost every day, somebody folds on the other side. And what we need to do is we're going to be changing all the rules and have the opportunity to go back and make the rules make sense economically, ideally moving to more and more free trade across more and more goods and commodities.
Jacobus, we've just got a minute.
I think that we will probably avert it. There's a lot at stake here. The challenge is for companies and investors that look at the trade and make investments in order to take advantage of producing one place or another. And if they are not sure they can plan accurately because they hear the noise, they get jittery. And that's where the problem comes.
Jacobus Bors, thank you very much. Christine Rees, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Like many of you, we are going to be taking the day off tomorrow for grilling and chilling and watching the local Independence Day parade. But GPB has you covered and will be running a special holiday program on the science of the 4th of July. So you can tune in for an explanation of what makes fireworks sparkle and what researchers have learned about the effects of patriotism and the pursuit of happiness on the brain. Doesn't mean we don't want to hear from you, though. What is your favorite 4th of July tradition? You can leave us a voicemail at 404-500-9457 or find us on Twitter and on Facebook. And then be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 o'clock for that special. A year ago, South Fulton declared independence and became its own chartered city. The new city in the southwestern part of Metro Atlanta is now making history on another front. As the only city in the nation where black women fill every major position in its judicial system. Chief Judge Tiffany Sellers said the goal is to ensure justice for everyone and added, "We want to be an example of how to do things right." My colleague Leah Fleming recently sat down with several of the women in power in South Fulton to see how it's going.
On a typical day in the city of South Fulton, Georgia's fifth largest and one of the newest cities, business as usual is taking place at City Hall. Just outside the front door, my producer and I are greeted by security.
You have any weapons of any sort?
I don't. I have my recorder here and then a few.
Okay, tell me you're a reporter.
Oh, sure.
Okay. All right.
We pass through and head to the lobby where the Wendy Williams Show is playing on the TV at the reception desk. And then we are led into a conference room to start our interview. Now, all of this is usual.
Oh, really? She has an AK, too.
I should have known.
Yes.
Only my sorrows.
But as we recognize that we're all members of the same black sorority, something emerges that is quite unique. What's unique is that all of these people that we have met so far are women, black women. Here in the city of 95,000 people, the judicial system, from the front door to the back, is led entirely by black women. And that's not it. Five of the seven people who make up city council, they're black women. Nowhere else in America will you find this. So I set out to talk with some of these women to find out how they're governing differently. I first sat down with Chief Judge Tiffany Carter Sellers, who says the group didn't immediately realize that they were making history in South Fulton.
I don't think that we really first realized it until maybe about a month ago, maybe a little less. The women who work in my department work really hard. We run court 6 days a week here. And so we spend the vast majority of our time working. and not, you know, kind of sitting around figuring out what the history is and what barriers we're breaking. We're just trying to get the job done every day.
So as an African-American woman, I know you've said that you're sensitive to the history of criminal justice in our country. Mm-hmm. And you have said that, you know, we as a team of people want to be an example of how to do things right.
Correct.
How do you do it right?
So there's a couple of things that we do differently that I think are right here in the city of South Fulton. For example, the law does not require that a person is appointed a public defender during their first appearance hearing. I certainly think that we can do that better. And so our city public defender, I've appointed her to represent every single person who's incarcerated in South Fulton on their first appearance hearing. For us to be such a new city, we have a very, very robust pretrial diversion program. It's called Second Chance South Fulton, where we really look to rehabilitate offenders. We certainly, for example, a lot of people are driving with no license, driving on a suspended license. Well, what do you need to do to fix that? You know, so we don't continuously have these suspended license, no license charges. So if there's things that we can do, programs, things of that nature, mentoring programs, we certainly divert people to those avenues. And so that's another way that we kind of do it different, and I think better here in South Fulton.
According to the Sentencing Project, African Americans are 5 times more likely to be incarcerated than whites. And in some states, that number is 10 times more likely. And I'm wondering, what do you think the justice system can do to change that? I know you're talking about the diversion programs.
Correct. I think that we really need to examine the root cause of recidivism. And I think that some of that is lack of opportunity, lack of resources, and quite honestly, mental health. And then I'll be quite candid. Another part of it is, you know, people in positions of power and authority don't look like us. They don't look like the people who have been incarcerated, and so they don't come from the same experiences and backgrounds. You know, I'm a wife to an African-American man. I have an African-American son, and I have an African-American brother. And so I'm sensitive to the treatment of African-American men in our country because it affects me so personally every day.
Yeah. I'm thinking when someone walks into your courtroom, they are seeing black women in every facet of that.
Correct.
And I mean, that's not something you typically see when you go into a courtroom.
It's not. It's not something you typically see when you practice law either. But it's not. It's not common.
Yeah.
And but I think that it makes us more relatable, particularly here in South Fulton, where our African American population is so high, that it makes us more relatable. There still are people who've had bad experiences in the justice system that bring those bad experiences that they've had previously into court. And so they quickly find out that we do it different and do it better here in South Fulton. And I've had several people afterwards say, you know what, Judge, I'm sorry because I had an attitude initially because I just knew that you were going to do X, Y, and Z because, you know, Judge down the street did it. And you just didn't do it that way. And so I'm sorry that I came in here with an attitude. I've had several people come back to me with that sort of response.
Mm-hmm.
And it's I feel like it's my job to show people that these barriers that have been kind of placed around the criminal justice system, we can break those. We can change our perception. You know, I've wanted to be a lawyer since I was 5, and it pains me kind of to see now how people view the profession that I held in such high, that I do hold in such high esteem, for such a long time.
Tiffany Carter Sellers is the chief judge of South Fulton. We spoke to her at City Hall. This is GPB Atlanta. Earlier, we spoke with Chief Judge Tiffany Carter Sellers, who says her goal is to change the way people view the criminal justice system.
I feel like it's my job to show people that these barriers that have been kind of placed around the criminal justice system, we can break those. We can change our perception.
Also working towards that goal is Interim Police Chief Sheila Rogers. I sat down with Rogers at City Hall in South Fulton to learn more about her police force and her thoughts on the tensions between law enforcement and minorities.
The South Fulton Police Department began on March 26, 2018. Of course, you already know the city became a city May 1st, 2017. And on March 5th, they named me as the interim chief. So I had approximately 2 weeks to help get us transition into a permanent role under the City of South Fulton government.
Mm-hmm.
We have approximately 90 employees. Most of the employees transferred from our previous department, Fulton County. So at this time, the main focus is to answer 911 calls for services.
All right. So as you know, the relationship between minority communities and officers has been incredibly tense, not just over the past few years, but really several decades. But thanks to social media, people of color and people can see it. It's more immediate and in their face. And I'm wondering, what do you make of that and how you actually serve the people?
As an employee of Fulton County, which I retired with over 25 years of service, we've always been community-oriented in South Fulton. Mm-hmm. The unincorporated portion became the city of South Fulton. It still has the same residents, the same businesses, the same visitors. So from a minority perspective, the community and the events that have been going on nationwide has always been of importance to us. We have a strong community service program in which we go out and speak to homeowner association meetings, town hall meetings. We work with our residents for security assessments. But for the community as a whole, our department has always been in touch with whom we work with. We had very few incidences which require a violent response. The community service aspect still continues, and it's because of our relationship with the community, our residents, our businesses, we're able to operate. So we're not alone in enforcing laws here in the city of South Fulton. We, as the South Fulton Police Department, we're building our relationship to be even stronger.
There have been studies that have shown that women officers are able to approach policing in a different way, which causes a different outcome than what we've seen on social media in terms of these violent interactions between people of color and the police. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that for the reasons of being female. Most persons, male and female, have a respect for a woman. And they have mothers, they have aunts, they have sisters, they have daughters. So I've seen situations where a male officer and a female officer go into a situation, and it may be a male of a larger size. And because the woman's approach may seem to be softer, but it's not. It's just a different mental approach in not just being tit for tat or strength or I'm in charge. They're able to diffuse a situation. I've done it for years. As far as the physical aspect, because of our training and the different weapons that we use that are non-violent, such as the taser, we're able to get situations under control a little easier or better than our counterparts, because sometimes you have male versus male and they want to dominate each other, and that's not what we're here for. We're here for resolution.
What is it that you think makes South Fulton such a unique place for women in power, because especially black women in power?
It was not planned for the ladies here in South Fulton. It just happened. But being that we all are the same race and same gender, we all have the same values. And we can bring those together, and instead of five fingers, you put them together, you have a fist. We can be a stronger force. So it was by accident that the black girl magic was created in that picture. But because of our experience, we can bring those things to the table to, for the good of South Fulton, make it a better environment. It won't just be a cookie cutter of you did wrong, you got a ticket, you went to court. We look deeper to find out what can we do to solve that situation.
That was my colleague and Morning Edition host Leah Fleming speaking with several of the African-American women leading the city of South Fulton. As always, we would love your feedback. Find us on Facebook or on Twitter, or leave us a message at 404-500-9457. I'm Virginia Prescott. Have a wonderful holiday. We'll be back on Thursday. On Second Thought is a production of Georgia Public Broadcasting. Thank you.